you've been buried in a lot of work on God and abstract objects. I want to get some definitions out in just a moment. We've done some things on this, but people can go to reasonablefaith.org as well as refer to your written work on this. A little background, what led you to this particular study?
Well, back in the early 1980s, as a young philosopher recently out of graduate school, I attended a conference of the Society of Christian Philosophers in Milwaukee, at which Thomas Morris, who was then at the University of Notre Dame, spoke. And Morris presented a paper called Absolute Creationism. And in this paper, he pointed out that in contradiction to the Orthodox Christian doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, which states that God has created everything other than himself, that there are objects that seem to be uncreated and even uncreatable. And what he had in mind were so-called abstract objects, things like numbers and sets and propositions and properties. Now, many of us who had been weaned on the work of Alvin Plantinga believe that there are such entities as propositions, properties, possible worlds, and mathematical objects. And yet Morris was arguing that these things, if they exist, exist necessarily and would seem to be incapable of being created. And the argument that he gave there has come to be called the bootstrapping argument. What he argues is that the person who thinks God has created these objects is caught in a sort of vicious circle, trying to pull himself up by his own bootstraps, which is impossible. Because consider, take the property of being powerful. This is certainly a property that God has because he's omnipotent. If God created the property of being powerful, then prior to his creating it logically, didn't God have to have some power? Well, of course, he had to be powerful in order to create the property of being powerful. So he already had the property of being powerful. So how could he create it? You can see the vicious circle that exists there. Some of these objects do not simply exist necessarily, but they seem to be uncreatable by their very nature. And although Morris attempted to answer this objection, his answer was so obviously ineffective and unconvincing that I left that conference with a very deep sense of trouble for theism, that this was an objection to theism that struck at the very heart of theism that I had no idea how to answer. And so I'd simply put it on the back burner for many years, and then a little over 10 years ago, decided to take it off the shelf and to begin to work on it, because this question is related to the doctrine of God's aseity, which is God's property of being self-existent. And the claim is that there are other things besides God that are self-existent and uncreated, namely these abstract objects. And so as part of my long-range research program of doing a philosophical analysis of the principal attributes of God, I decided it was high time for me to tackle aseity and to meet head-on the challenge posed by these abstract objects. And so that's what I've been embroiled in as my major research project for more than a decade now.
What material do you go to read on this?
Principally, it's philosophy of mathematics, Kevin, because the most important philosophical issue, I think, raised among philosophers of mathematics is the ontological status of these objects. That is to say, do you think that the number two actually exists? Now, certainly there are two apples, say, or two glasses on the table, but apart from the glasses or the apples, does the number two itself exist?
And if you were to write it on a chalkboard, that would be a representation
yes,
of the number two.
Yes, that would be a numeral, not a number. There are different numerals, for example, Arabic numerals that we use, but then there are Roman numerals that look very different than our Arabic numerals. But these, as you say, are simply representations of the number two, which, if it exists, is not any kind of a physical thing. It would be an abstract object that would apparently exist beyond time and space.
We learned from elementary school that there is a distinction between abstract and concrete, that these seem to be the two big things that stand in opposition and that need to be distinguished.
Yes.
So,
well, you're certainly right in saying that this is a major bifurcation of reality that metaphysicians point to. Peter Van Inwagen, who is a very prominent Christian philosopher and metaphysician, has said that the difference between abstract objects and concrete objects is so great that even the difference between God and creatures pales by comparison to the difference between abstract and concrete objects. So that this would be a major dividing line in reality, in one's ontology of what exists.
Stanford University says it is widely agreed that the distinction between abstract and concrete is of fundamental importance, and yet there is no standard account of how it should be drawn. I think even the similar things that it's difficult to perhaps define what is abstract.
Yes, that's very true. And so what philosophers typically do is just point to paradigm examples that everybody agrees would be abstract if they exist. Numbers, propositions, things of that sort, but even also works of art or novels or musical compositions. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is not identical with any series of ink marks on paper.
Or wavelengths from the violin?
Well, not even that. That's right, because otherwise it would cease to exist when the orchestra no longer is playing.
Yeah.
If it's the wavelengths. And if the manuscript were burned up, then Beethoven's Fifth Symphony would cease to exist, but obviously that's not the case. So again, these things like a score, a musical score, or a performance are taken to be just tokens or instances of this abstract entity, which is Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which is not identical with any of its tokens, at least for those who believe in abstract entities. So as I say, there is not a universally agreed upon definition, but there is pretty much universal agreement on many of these paradigm cases. Now, I think that abstract objects are definable in terms of their causal effeateness. That is to say, what distinguishes an abstract from a concrete object is that concrete objects have causal powers, whereas abstract objects have no causal powers. They are utterly impotent and effete and cannot be causes of anything.
The number 7 can't cause anything.
Right. Has no effects.
But a rock could fall on your head and cause a bruise.
I mean,
you know, that, I just got to say as a layman, that has really helped me, that distinction. But it's almost like...
And that is widely agreed upon by philosophers. Not universally, but I think very, very widely shared.
I'm Googling Stanford Encyclopedia here, Bill. It says some of these paradigm examples. In other words, if we can get some clear-cut examples, that will help. And said, you know, some paradigm examples of concrete things are like rocks and trees and human beings, magnetic fields, protons, stars. But some clear cases of abstractions or abstracta are classes, propositions, concepts, the letter A, the number 2, and Dante's Inferno.
Oh, see, there was a literary work.
Isn't that interesting?
The Inferno is not identical with any particular paper token of it. These could all be burned up, and yet that wouldn't mean that there was no such thing as Dante's Inferno anymore. Maybe it could be preserved on a computer instead of in a paper book. So yes, that would be an example again of where someone looks at a literary art piece or literary work as being an abstract object.
Our good friend J.P. Moreland has a bumper sticker on his car. It says, "I break for universals." So, in other words, he does believe in the existence of things like universals and some of these abstracts, that they actually exist, but they're not extended in space. I know that the two of you need to have a long conversation on that sometime, but that is a funny bumper sticker.
It is, it is, because if universals exist, at least on Platonism, they don't exist in the physical concrete world. They would be abstract objects that would exist not in space. And universals, for those who are unfamiliar with the terminology, would be things that can be multiply instantiated. For example, the property red can be exemplified by many different things. There's a red fire truck, a red dress, a red flower, and the property of being red would be this abstract object, which is exemplified by all of these particular red-colored things. And so the idea there is that redness is a universal which exists in multiple places.
Tell me, Bill, where immateriality plays into this. If something is immaterial, I mean, obviously an abstract object would not be a material object.
Right, because you see, if it were material, you could bump into it. It would have causal power. So an abstract object, if it is causally effete, can't be a material thing.
And God is not an abstract object, but he's immaterial.
Good
so
point.
We have this.
So immateriality would be a necessary, but not a sufficient condition of being abstract. There are concrete objects that are immaterial. Now, that may sound a little paradoxical to some people. Concrete sounds like material, but in this case, by concrete, one doesn't mean physical or material. One means that it's something that is not abstract. It has causal power. So souls, angels, God would all be examples of concrete objects that are immaterial.
So the first thing that you mentioned about how God and abstract objects, some of the problems are that power would be something that God has, but yet he creates power. And so that's one of the problems. What are some more problems as far as God and abstract objects? And by the way, clarify that again for me.
Well, the idea there is that according to the Bible and Christian tradition, God is the creator of everything other than himself. John 1:3 says of the Logos, who is Christ, all things came into being through him, and without him, nothing has come into being. So that verse teaches the universal scope of God's creation. Everything other than God and his own Logos, his mind, has been created by God. So if a person believes there are abstract objects, he must say, I think theologically, he must say that these are created by God. But as I explained, it seems that it's impossible for some of these things to be created because you get into a vicious circle.
Yeah,
in order
yeah.
to create the property of being powerful, you already have to have the property of being powerful.
So what does this bring up? Something to be co-eternal with God?
They would be co-eternal with God, which is another problem because the scripture does say that everything other than God is created by God, and therefore the created order had a beginning. There is a state of affairs in the actual world which consists of God and God alone. And yet on this view, if there are these abstract objects, they're co-eternal with God. Indeed, God is just an infinitesimal part of reality. He is surrounded by infinities of infinities of infinities of beings that are uncreated by him and co-eternal with him. And his creation of the physical universe is an infinitesimal triviality compared to the realms of uncreated being.
If, in fact, these abstract objects...
If they are real.
Okay. Could we say that God is somehow ontologically prior than these abstract objects, even though they seem to be co-eternal with him?
Well, that is what the absolute creationist wants to say, that God has created these things, but that's difficult, as I say, because it gets you into a vicious circle. In that ontologically prior state, was God powerful or wasn't he? Well, if he wasn't, then how could he create the property of being powerful? But if he was powerful already then, didn't he already have the property of being powerful? And if you say, no, he didn't, but he was powerful anyway, well, then why create the property of being powerful? It seems to become obtuse then.
I tried to get around it, but I couldn't. I'm thinking of what God may be logically prior to.
Well, obviously, the priority we're talking about here is not chronological priority. We're talking about explanatory priority or logical priority. And it is precisely then that you run into this bootstrapping problem.
What about simultaneous? Would that just be a euphemism for co-eternal?
That wouldn't help because, again, we're talking about explanatory priority that's not related to time.
Well, if you were to kind of tick off some of the problems in theology and philosophy that this brings up, we've looked at maybe two. Can you spell out some more?
No, I think that this is the main one. This is huge.
Oh, it's big enough. Believe me. Yeah, it is huge. So, in other words...
Well, actually, I guess there is another one that perhaps is equally huge that is related to this. Let's suppose that there are these properties like omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, eternity that God has by his very nature, all right? What that means is God is who he is in virtue of his nature. But if these properties that constitute God's nature are uncreated by him, then that means that God depends upon these properties for being God. He is God because he has these properties which exist independently of him. So that this would mean that God is, in fact, not a self-existent being. He is dependent upon these independently existing abstract objects.
Wow. Does Swinburne believe something like this?
No. Swinburne solves the problem by denying that abstract objects exist.
Ah. I was trying to, as I understand, Swinburne doesn't believe that God is a necessary being.
Well, so that's true.
I wondered how that played into it. So he just denies
that. That would be more the view of Keith Yandell, who believes both that God is a contingent being like Swinburne, but then, unlike Swinburne, also believes that there are these necessarily existing abstract objects. Yandell is a Christian philosopher from the University of Wisconsin.
Well, let's talk about the book that you're participating in, Bill. But first of all, can you get us off the hook here and solve this problem?
Well, that's the problematic of the book. Paul Gould is editing a book on God and abstract objects in which he has assembled a team of six philosophers to engage this question and try to come to different perspectives on the problem.
It's a concrete book with concrete yes. philosophers, and you're one
yes,
of them.
Yes, that's right. I am one of several that are participating in this view, six views on God and abstract objects.
Okay. Have you had a chance to review the other views?
Oh, yes. Yes, the book consists of six chapters written by each of us, our position papers, and then each person responds to the other five chapters, and then finally, you are given a chance to respond to your five critics.
Give us a thumbnail of some of the other views represented.
Well, Paul Gould, the editor of the book, and Rich Davis have written one chapter, which is a sort of modified absolute creationism. They hold that God creates many abstract objects, except for the properties that make up his own nature. And there, they seem willing to embrace Platonism, although Platonism is the view that abstract objects exist. I regard it as a kind of compromise position where they will try to defend the view that God creates most of these, but not the properties that make up his own nature. Keith Yandell, whom I've already mentioned, is the Platonist in the group. He believes that abstract objects exist, that they are uncreated by God, and he even thinks that God is not necessary in his existence. So Yandell has a very radical view, I think, thoroughly Platonistic, and he just sees no theological problem at all. He is quite blasé about the problem posed by abstract objects to divine aseity or creation. Also in the book would be Greg Welty, who I believe did his doctoral dissertation on this subject under Swinburne, and Welty feels keenly the theological problem posed to divine aseity by the reality of these objects. And so he adopts a view called divine conceptualism, and he identifies what we normally refer to as abstract objects, things like numbers, propositions, properties, as the contents of God's mind. So he takes a view that is really classical Augustinian view, that what we thought were abstract objects are actually ideas in the mind of God, or thoughts in God's mind. I take the view that a defensible position for the Christian theist is that there are no abstract objects. These things are just useful fictions. They do not, in fact, exist. And I deal with the most important argument that Platonists offer on behalf of their existence and attempt to show that this argument doesn't go through, and that, therefore, a perfectly defensible view is that there are no abstract objects, and therefore everything is concrete and is created by God. The next participant is Scott Schalkowski, and he takes a view that's rather similar to mine, I'm pleased to say. We are fairly closely aligned in our views in this book. He also would say, I think, that abstract objects don't exist, but he also doesn't think it's theologically problematic if they do. So he, like Yandell, is oddly blasé about this problem, but in fact, he doesn't think they exist. He doesn't say they're useful fictions. Instead, Schalkowski's view seems to be that talk about abstract objects is just a sort of figurative language. We can express truths by using figures of speech that aren't literally true. For example, if I said, it's raining cats and dogs outside, that can be a true statement, even though there are no animals falling from the sky. It's a figure of speech to say, it's raining cats and dogs, which means it's raining very hard. Similarly, he would say, when we say things like, two is the number of men that entered the bar, what we really mean is that two men entered the bar. And we don't really mean to postulate an entity two in existence to the men. It's just the men that went into the bar. And it's just a way of speaking to say two is the number of the men who entered the bar. So he sees abstract talk as not literal, but I think more figurative. And then the final participant is the atheist philosopher Graham Oppy from Australia. And Oppy's view is that the existence of abstract objects has no implications for either naturalism or for theism. But the reason he says that is because he holds or speaks of a very thin or attenuated sort of naturalism or theism. Normally, the naturalist is a physicalist who believes that only material objects exist. And so the naturalist would normally be very disturbed by thinking that there are these abstract objects that are real and are out there. But Oppie's naturalism is very attenuated. It just amounts to denying that God exists or something of that sort. And as for theism, again, Oppie's theism that he entertains would just be that there is a sort of being who is the creator of the world and is good and is worshipped and so forth. But he doesn't need to be the creator of literally everything that exists. So Oppie is also very indifferent to this question. He thinks it is of no significance for either theism or for naturalism.
Well, Bill, would a more orthodox view or perhaps a biblical view of God just somehow anchor abstract objects in God, in God's mind?
Well, that's what the conceptualist, like Welty, would say, that abstract objects are ideas in the mind of God. And certainly that is, I think, probably the mainstream theistic position that was defended by Augustine, and I think Aquinas would hold something similar, and the ancient Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria thought this. So divine conceptualism is, for me, a kind of fallback position. If my view doesn't work out, I'm prepared to fall back on divine conceptualism. But as I began to study this issue, it seemed to me that even divine conceptualism concedes too much to the Platonist in thinking that there have to be reference of things like the word to or propositions or other mathematical objects. And therefore, like Schalkowski, I'm very suspicious that we're being deceived by our language, that we are reifying linguistic terms into entities and thinking that our language is a sort of mirror of reality. This is sometimes called the picture theory of meaning, that every word pictures something in reality. And I think that's clearly false, Kevin. I mean, for example, when I say the whereabouts of the prime minister are unknown, I don't mean that there's some object in the world called whereabouts that actually exists. So it's not true that every noun or noun phrase that we use in our true sentences refers to some object that actually exists in the world.
When you say reify, does it mean to make something real? That
yes.
A mistake we often make is philosophers make and physicists make it, reifying nothing.
That's a perfect example. If you say the universe was created from nothing, then because nothing is a noun in that sentence, right, it's the object of a preposition, someone might be tempted to reify it and turn nothing into a thing. And so as to say it was created from nothing, well, how was that done? What properties does nothing have? And this leads then to just endless confusion. I think we've talked about this before. If I said I had nothing for lunch today, it would be obtuse for you to say, well, how did it taste? Or was it filling?
It tastes like chicken.
Yeah, that would be absurd. And that would be an example of reifying linguistic terms and thinking they refer to objects or realities.
When you say that these things are just useful fictions, it all sounds like they're concepts. But you wouldn't consider your position conceptualism?
I don't think it's conceptualism, because I'm not saying that the number two is an idea that exists in the mind of God. I certainly think God does have an idea of the number two, but so do I, and so do you. And if you think that the number two, I mean, now think about this, Kevin. If the number two is literally in God's mind, then what is it that you're thinking about when you think about the number two? It's got to be something else, because it's in your mind.
Yeah,
You're not in the mind of God. And so I think that conceptualism leads to some really problematic sorts of conclusions of this sort. If you say that literally these objects are these thoughts in the mind of God, since I don't have those, that would mean I don't have any thought of two or proposition or something. So I think it's preferable to just say that there are no such objects, but we can have ideas of things that aren't real.
If they're outside of the human mind, that means we discover abstract objects. If they're somehow anchored in God's mind, the conceptualist,
yes,
the divine mind, then we discover them,
right,
just as part of creation. We don't determine what
is
abstract.
Well, they wouldn't be part of creation. Right?
Well, that's right. They'd be co-eternal and all the whole.
Yes,
you know.
But you're right about discovering them.
Okay, you know, you don't determine what is abstract. We tend to discuss.
You find it. Yes, and this leads to interesting questions. For example, you talked about Dante's Inferno. Well, who created the poem Dante's Inferno or Beethoven's Fifth? Who composed Beethoven's Fifth? If it's an abstract object, then
that's
maybe
a good point.
Beethoven and Dante really didn't do it. They just sort of discovered it, which then means that they're not really as great creators and artists as we might think.
Yeah, I don't see how they could just, how Beethoven's Fifth could just be discovered by Beethoven. I see how it could be created and arranged.
Yeah. Yes. And in all fairness, some Platonists who think that literary works and musical works are abstract will also endorse that these are products of human creation. But it's difficult to see why that would be the case if they're abstract objects. Why wouldn't they just always be there and Beethoven and Dante just happen to hit upon them? Which for anyone who has a deep appreciation of art and aesthetics is a very unpalatable view.
And it really sends me into a tizzy there even thinking about it, because you could have Beethoven's Fifth with one note that would be different.
Yeah, that's a different abstract object.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. You know, I mean, wait, that's not right.
Right.
Wow. Well, Bill, you've really been doing some work.
Yeah, this is very, very heavy metaphysics and very challenging, because this is a question, obviously, as I say, that's of interest to non-theists as well. Philosophers of mathematics and philosophers of language wrestle with these questions wholly independently of their theological significance. In fact, I think that many of them would be quite surprised to hear that philosophers of religion are interested in these debates and are participating in them. And so I will be interested to see their reaction to this book that Gould is editing, because it will probably show applications of their work theologically that they would never have anticipated.
Let's definitely visit this topic again, especially after the book comes out.
Right.
Thank you, Dr. Craig.